Good afternoon, brethren. Certainly good to see you all this afternoon. Many, many thanks to our choir and Mr. Prince. They have done an excellent job this week in providing some beautiful music for us. I hope your feast has been as good as ours has been. Coming down from Wisconsin, we always love coming close to back home. We're from Western Illinois originally, so it's always nice to see old friends and family. And meet new people. I did notice one thing this feast, though, and while I haven't met every single one of you, I have a pretty good representation. I have come to the conclusion that I am the only one here without an accent. Some of you talk funny. I am honored to be here with you this afternoon, and I wasn't completely trying to get out of the sermon this afternoon when I suggested to Mr. Dobson, after the sermon by Mr. Dick, what else needs to be said, but he didn't buy it, so it's good to be here with you all. I'd like to start my sermon today by reading to you something that I keep on my desk. It's a small placard that actually my mother-in-law gave to me many years ago. And it's on my desk, and I look at it every day, and it says this. Let me read it to you. It says, I have the powerful awareness that I've made the right decision and am moving in the right direction. Let me read that again. I have the powerful awareness. Now, I'm not talking about some New Age mumbo-jumbo here. I'm talking about, I guess maybe a better way to state it is, I know in my very core that I've made the right decision by yielding to God's calling and in moving in the right direction. It goes on to say, I will let nothing and no one deter, detour, distract, depress, or defeat me. It says, I will be faithful. I will be persistent. I will be determined. And I will not quit. See, brethren, I read this every day, and it's not just something that gets me going every day. It's something that I believe in wholeheartedly. And I know in my heart of hearts now that I will not quit. Now, my wife, who's unable to join us this afternoon, will say, well, he's just stubborn. I hear that a lot. And no matter what she says, she'll never convince me I'm not. But, brethren, I will not quit, and I want to talk to you today in this message, this last message of the 2018 Feast of Tabernacles, last great day, eighth great day. My message to you today is one of persistence and one of overcoming. My goal this afternoon is to have you leave here, whether it's this afternoon or tomorrow or in the next couple of days, to have you leave Branson this year knowing, not hoping, not let's see what happens, knowing, God willing, that you will be at the feast again in 2019. Again, knowing, not hoping, that you will persevere and that you will overcome whatever obstacles are in your way. The title of my sermon today simply is Overcoming. And I want to look at this topic from a slightly different angle. Mr. Dobson had kind of alluded to, I had some people asking me about new truths, so definitely had to stomp that out pretty quick. No new truths today. But I do want to talk about four different people that you might not know a lot about. But we're going to talk about the courage of four men, Abishai, Sibbecai, Elhanan, and Jonathan. I'm pretty sure you probably have all read their stories, probably more than once. We all know the story of David and Goliath. We can think back over the years, all the messages we've heard, sermonettes, sermons, Bible studies, all those lessons, those powerful lessons that we learned about how David, this teenage boy, stood up to this giant of a man and came out victorious. We're not going to talk about him today. That's enough. We know that story, right? It is a great story about overcoming, but I don't want to use it. What I want to ask is, why don't our children know the amazing story about the courage and the honor, again, of Abishai, Sibbecai, Elhanan, and Jonathan? And you're saying, well, who are those people? Who are they? Well, believe it or not, these four men did the same thing as David. Every single one of these men, and we'll look at their story, slew a Philistine giant. And as we get into their story here in a few minutes, we're going to see that, as a matter of fact, each one of them slew a giant of the immediate family of Goliath. Is that starting to maybe ring a bell? Have you heard of them? You see, we don't tell this heroic tale to our children. And I, as a matter of fact, don't remember it being used in sermons. But we're going to do that just today. You can start turning over, if you want to 2 Samuel chapter 21. We're going to look at this brief story of four men who again, just like David, stood up against a Philistine giant alone and, from what we can tell, apparently helpless to actually accomplish such a feat. But as we see as we go through this, they did it anyway. And as along the way, we're going to see what we as Christians today can learn from their example that has kind of faded into the obscure pages of our Bible. And again, is rarely referred to. So 2 Samuel chapter 21, we're going to pick up the story there. And there are two accounts. There's a parallel account, and we'll go there as well, in 1 Chronicles chapter 20. And we'll read from both of those as we move through. But first from 2 Samuel. Let's start down, jump right in here. Let's start down to 2 Samuel 21, verse 15. 2 Samuel 21, verse 15. It says, when the Philistines were at war again, note that word because we'll talk about it and refer to it a few more times. When the Philistines were at war again with Israel, David and his servants servants with him went down and fought against the Philistines, and David grew faint. Now hold your place there and flip over to 1 Chronicles chapter 20. Again, this the parallel account is in 1 Chronicles chapter 20, verse 4. And it simply says this. Now it happened afterwards that war broke out at Gezer with the Philistines. So again, we're talking about the same event here in these two. One of the things we're going to notice as we start here, I pointed out the word again, is we're going to notice that it seemed that Israel, I want to say was always at war with the Philistines, but often. And when I put this sermon together, it really got me to thinking, why couldn't they just once and for all conquer them? To go up against these giants if they had to. David slew a giant right away. Why couldn't they just vanquish this enemy that just kept coming back again and again? Again, then, let's look at this. 2 Samuel chapter 21, verse 15. We'll also notice that David now was starting to show his age. We see here that he tired easily, and it seemed that he just wasn't up to the struggle. We can see here at the end of verse 15, it says, and David grew faint. Does that sound like you sometimes? It seems like you've been fighting the same enemy year after year. It keeps coming back. You know, you thought you slew it, and it's back. It just won't go away. You know, maybe when you were younger, you thought you'd really dealt it a death blow, right? Just like David when he was young. He stepped up to the plate. He slew the giant Goliath and he cut off his head. Do you remember that time? You're just early in the church. Maybe you just got baptized. You remember that feeling? You were victorious. You had made it, right? Now you can do anything. You can fight any foe. You can win any battle. And then you realize as the years go on that it just keep those enemies, those giants, those things we're working on just keep coming back. Year after year after year. And you wonder sometimes, why can't I have any peace? Why do you have to keep on fighting? Well, brethren, as we'll see and as we know the story of David, just like David fighting the Philistines, you and I are at war too. And it does seem to never end. Hold your place in 2 Samuel, if you would, please. And let's go back to 2 Corinthians, chapter 10. I really appreciated Mr. DeMoor's sermon the other day. It was very inspiring to me, as he also discussed some of the giants that many of us and many of you are dealing with. And I really appreciate it. Almost felt bad for turning his watch ahead 30 minutes to make sure he didn't go overtime. But almost felt bad. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 3, please. It says in verse 3, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh." We understand this. We've heard about this week. "For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ." Ever since that day when God first called you, you've been fighting a spiritual war. Every single one of us have. We understand, we've heard messages over the last few weeks, since even before the Day of Atonement, that the enemy that we're fighting, of course, is Satan the devil. And ever since we were called, we've been struggling against him. And we vowed, in my words, we'll say this, to go to war against him. And when we were baptized, you remember, every one of us here, we promised that we wouldn't turn back. We were determined to win no matter what. And as we grew in the faith, we also then learned to see that sometimes we appeared so weak against such a giant of an enemy. And at times we may throw your hands up and say, "I don't know what to do. How can I possibly overcome him? How can we possibly conquer this evil, sinful world, this satanic world that we're a part of?" And again, as we grew in knowledge and as God opened our eyes more, we began to learn that everything that we had come out of in regards to this world, all of our past beliefs and values, everything that we had known before was represented by our enemy, Satan the devil. And then came that day when we were baptized, right? We had a victory over the enemy. Do you remember that day? Do you remember that feeling you had when you came up out of the water? You'd been built up to it. You'd been counseled about the importance of this and how it must happen. And then when that minister laid hands on you and prayed over you, do you remember that? That joy? That spiritual high you were on? I remember that day well. My wife reminded me that mine lasted for about an hour, because after that we went to church and some guy pulled out in front of me and I thought, "Why, you dirty rat?" But I remember it. When we were baptized, right? It was like a death blow to our enemy. We won. Do you remember that feeling? We felt victorious. All those people around us hugging us and congratulating us, welcoming us into God's family. And for a while, you remember, everything was great. We were at peace. But the peace was not to last, right? We soon learned that there were more battles to fight. That the enemy wasn't dead and he wasn't giving up. It seemed as if he had sons. They were coming at us at times from all directions. And we learned early on that we needed to get on our knees and pray and ask God to give us the courage, to summon that courage and determination to continue the fight. And every one of us learned early on that it was going to last the rest of our natural lives. Let's continue the story. I should have had you hold your place in 2 Samuel 21, but since you've been there once, it's easy to find, right? 2 Samuel 21, we started in verse 15, let's go to verse 16. This part of the account is only recorded here in 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel chapter 21, verse 16. And it says, then Ishbi Benab, Ishbi Benab. Of course, I couldn't pick a villain with a name easy like Bob or Carl or something. Ishbi Benab, who was Goliath's son, right? He was one of the sons of the giants. So he's now the Philistine champion. The weight of whose bronze spear was 300 shekels, which is about 8 pounds, about what a gallon of milk weighs. Who was bearing a new sword thought he could kill David. So remember what we read about in this verse 15. As the Philistines came up again and they were doing battle, it talked about David grew weary. So we have this Philistine champion now who might have thought David was wounded, right? We don't know. But I can imagine that he also thought now that this is a great time for me to become famous for killing the great King David of Israel. And as he's a son of Goliath, to revenge his father's death. But it says here then, but Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, came to his aid and struck the Philistine and killed him. And according to what I could find, it seemed Abishai was kind of like David's chief of staff, if you will. So again, picture this. We have Ishbi Benab, Carl, we'll call him Carl. So while Carl, this big guy, is racing forward to thrust this giant sword into King David, Abishai, this, you know, man of our stature, right, a normal-sized person, reacts in a split second. He leaps forward just in time to get his shield over David, and the sword hits his shield. Now, I probably watched too many James Bond movies or action movies, so I got this video playing in my head, and it might not be quite as elaborate as what my video is. But we can see here that Carl is mad. He's enraged at Abishai. Just think about it. He yanks back that sword to now thrust it at Abishai. But Abishai is this small, agile man, and he quickly dodges out of the way. And in a split second, Abishai is the one who thrusts his sword into Carl and kills him. Once again, the Philistines see their giant champion has been killed, and that's enough for them. They hightail it out of there. And so we now have two men, two small men, I will call them, as compared to these giants, two small men that have defeated a giant of an enemy who would dare strike at the king of Israel. And we can see as we read on here that the men around King David, though, are getting kind of concerned for their aging king. They said, then the men of David swore to him, saying, you shall go out no more with us to battle, lest you quench the lamp of Israel. Right? They're saying, in other words, King David, we love you, but you're not a spring chicken anymore, right? We don't want you to die. You're the light we follow. You're our leader, and we can't risk you getting killed in battle. Basically, they said, let us take care of it. Let me pause for just a second and ask you, do you think, perhaps, that God was instrumental in helping Abishai defeat Carl? This normal-sized man, again, coming up a Philistine giant, do you think God had anything to do with him defeating Ishbi Benab? This giant of a man looks at David and thinks, he's helpless. He's physically weak. And who is with David? This small Abishai. Logically speaking, he didn't have a chance against Ishbi Benab. I picture a man of small stature, like maybe a person who rides horses, a jockey, 4'8", you know, 110 pounds, against a 6'8", 350-pound offensive lineman in the NFL. He doesn't have a chance. He's not going to win without any help. And I wonder what went through his mind and think, why didn't Abishai make the logical conclusion that I'm going to die and I need to get out of here? Why did he keep fighting for his king despite the overwhelming evidence that he would probably die in the process? I think my real question, or my question should be this, is what are we learning so far from this story that we can apply to our lives today? We'll come back to that. Let's go on with the story, dropping down here to verse 18. It says, "Now it happened afterward that there was again a battle with the Philistines at Gob. Then Sibekai, the Hushathite, killed Saph, who was one of the sons of the giant." So again, here, another son of Goliath. Hold your place. Let's look at 1 Chronicles 20, verse 4. Are you guys familiar with this story? These stories? We know about David and Goliath. He must have had a better PR man or something. I don't know. 1 Chronicles 20, verse 4. Here's the parallel account. It says, "At which time Sibekai, the Hushathite, killed Sipai," that's another name for Saph, "who was one of the sons of the giant, and they were subdued." So again, it seems to me amazingly that the Philistines are kind of slow learners. They never seem to give up. Again, they've sent their giant champion against Israel. And this time his name is Saph, or we see Sipai, again, apparently a son of Goliath. And we know that David isn't really able to do anything about it because his advisors have told him that shouldn't be fighting, that he might be too old or too feeble to fight. But we see Sibekai stepping up to the plate, and he takes care of business. We have no other details from this except that he won. Again, apparently, once again, over impossible odds. And I hope you see, obviously, with God's direct intervention. But notice what it says at the end of, in 1 Chronicles 20, at the end of verse 4, it says, "The Philistines are subdued." Other translations say they were humbled and defeated. Brethren, God is clearly showing his power to defeat strong enemies, even when it seems absolutely impossible to do so. Flip back to 2 Samuel 21, let's time verse 19. 2 Samuel 21, verse 19. The first word, again. "There was war at Gob with the Philistines." So they're back again and in the same place. It says, "Where Elhanan, the son of Jeor-Oregim, the Bethlehemite, killed," this time we're talking about he killed the brother of Goliath the Gittite, "the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam." Now, hold your place. Flip back to 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5. Just quickly, we'll read that. 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5, it says, "Again, there was war with the Philistines, and Elhanan, the son of Jair, killed Lami," we're talking about the same giant, "the brother of Goliath the Gittite, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam." Now, that sounds pretty impressive. But what are we talking here? How big is a weaver's beam? Well, as I dug into this, it appears that the spear would have been about 3 inches in diameter. So just to put it in perspective, say the bottom of a soda can. So you're wrapping your hands around something about that big around. They say that the spear would have been between 6.5 and 7.5 feet long, and would have had a 15-pound spearhead on it. Let's put that in perspective. I mentioned a gallon of milk weighs about 8 pounds, 8.2 pounds. So imagine just less than 2 gallons of milk that you're holding on a spear that big around and wielding this thing in battle. It was massive. I guess imagine the man that was holding on to it, that was able to wield it. Again, Lami, it says, must have been between 9.5 and 10.5 feet tall. And we don't have many details provided, but we're left to wonder, or at least I am, what is wrong with those Philistines? Why can't they learn their lesson, stop sending their giants after the Israelites? Because obviously, their track record's really bad, and they're not going to win. But we see they still do, time and again. We have an unknown man. We mentioned their name so far, barely mentioned in the Bible. Displaying incredible courage and trust in God to slay Lami. Again, here described as the brother of Goliath. Brethren, can you see the repetitiveness of this story? Can you see God demonstrating clearly over and over and over again that despite these continuing attacks by these giants, they just keep coming back. They will not leave the Israelites alone. That God, that He is going to defend Israel and use these small, seemingly helpless, seemingly maybe defenseless men to accomplish this miraculous task. We're not done yet. Turn back to 2 Samuel 21. Second Samuel 21, verse 20. We won't go to the parallel account this time in 1 Chronicles because it repeats this almost word for word. But 2 Samuel 21, verse 20, how does it start out? Yet again, there was war at Gath, where there was a man of great stature. So again, we're talking about a giant who had six fingers on each hand and six toes on each foot, 24 in number, and he was also born to the giant, so one of Goliath's sons. And then very interestingly it says, so when he defied Israel, we'll come back to that, Jonathan, the son of Shimeah, David's brother, so we're talking about a nephew here, killed him. Now I mentioned the parallel account repeats that almost word for word. But there are a couple things to notice. First of all, we know he's a giant, but he's an oddity. You know, they point that out. Six fingers on each hand, six toes on each foot. And you have to wonder if the Philistines thought that maybe this made him special. You know, I don't know. Maybe they thought it gave him some extra abilities or extra power. I don't know that. But at the very least, I bet they thought the Israelites or anybody coming up against this oddity, this freak of nature, would be duly impressed. Right? Oh, intimidated by this person who is also this gigantic man. But also let's notice what he did. It said, he defied Israel. It says he defied Israel. Now, perhaps the other giants did too, but it's not mentioned specifically except in that original story of David and Goliath when Goliath defied the armies of the living God. What we see here is Jonathan wasn't about to let that happen. But notice what it says, that he didn't take action until this unnamed giant, we don't know what his name was, defied Israel, and by doing so, defied God. Brethren, we can conclude that Jonathan was like the rest of these men we've described, that he was of normal stature, that he, on paper, or standing next to each other, he was no match physically for this giant. Would not be possible, or we wouldn't suspect that Jonathan could get the upper hand on this giant. You know, again, how would he have the courage to face this person? Well, I'm pretty sure he was aware of recent history. He knew the story of his uncle, David, who did this. He knew the story of Abishai and the ones who have preceded him. He knew the story. That's how he had the courage. He had seen God's hand evident in helping these other men slay these giants that had been sent against Israel. But I believe firmly that what he did have more than anything is that he had the faith that God would once again give him the strength to conquer this giant enemy. So, brethren, we've seen the evidence, and we're left to ask this question. And I'll ask you directly, every one of you, do you know that God will intervene for you and give you the strength to conquer your giant spiritual enemies? Do you know that in your heart? Have you seen it in your life before? Have you ever seen him fight for you before and deliver you from your enemies? Brethren, what is it that we need to do? What are the things that we need to fight against our enemies that just seem to keep coming back again and again to attack us? Brethren, I see an auditorium here with many, many, all of you. I'm not sure how many of you there are, but I see an auditorium full of fellow co-heirs with Christ. That's who you are. And there is only one thing, or I'm going to say one person, who can keep you out of God's kingdom. And that's you. God's promised that you'll be there if we just yield to him. You and I have a crown awaiting us if we don't let someone else take it, if we really want it. Do you want that? Do you want that crown? You see, God had given you his Holy Spirit upon baptism, and if we allow it to work in our lives and course through our veins, and if we begin to yield more to God, we are promised, you are promised, every single one of you I see in this auditorium are promised to be in God's kingdom. I can't imagine anything better, even as my spiritual giants continue to come back and fight me along the way. Turn, if you would, back to Ephesians chapter 6, and we'll start in verse 10. We'll read verses 10 through 13. What are the things, brethren, that we need to fight against our enemies that just seem to keep coming back to attack us time and time again? Ephesians 6, verse 10, it says, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places." Verse 13, "Therefore take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand." It's saying, doing everything you can, no matter what, to stand. Brethren, we all clearly understand that and recognize that the source of our spiritual problems, we've talked about it in this feast many times, come from Satan. We understand that. We have to recognize that that's the source of our problems and then use the spiritual armor of God described here to guard against these attacks that just won't stop. But I want to ask you too, what have we noticed in this story that we've read today, this story of the slayings of these four giants of the Philistines, that we also must apply in our spiritual battles as we try to overcome? Well, my main point, brethren, that I'm trying to get at is that we have to be courageous. We have to trust God, and we have to go on the offensive. We just can't sit back and wait for whatever's going to come. I believe firmly, and we've been taught over the years, that sometimes we just have to take the battle to the enemy. And in this case, Satan. We have to take the battle to him, and we have to destroy him again and again and again, no matter how often he comes back. We understand he's not going to stop until Christ has him put in a bottomless pit. And he's a very wary adversary. He's a formidable adversary, I say. He understands. He continues oftentimes to attack us in the same way, in the same places, over and over and over again. Perhaps he thinks that we'll get tired, that we'll get weary, and will say, I can't do this anymore. I can't. I can't do it. So, brethren, what are your giants? Probably isn't a 10-foot guy carrying a 6-foot long sword, right? What are your giants? And who cares if you slay him or not? Who's going to notice? Well, brethren, just like these giant slayers that we read about here in these obscure chapters of 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles, who's going to know the courage it took for you to fight against your spiritual enemies? You're way ahead of me, I'm sure. Obviously, God the Father and Jesus Christ the Son know, and they will notice. Perhaps your story will even be written about someday. As you think about us as a church, or even just as a large congregation here in Branson, there are many giants out there among us. And I know it's true that some of them have attacked you time and time again, haven't they? They won't stop. Perhaps maybe you thought your giant was slain and gone for good when you were baptized. And perhaps, like me, you were surprised that they kept coming back again and again, trying to destroy you over and over again. What are some of those giants we face, brethren? Some of the things we've heard about, again, Mr. DeMore talked about some of them, but some of those giants include extended health problems. Maybe they're financial difficulties or family problems. Maybe they're relationship problems or hurt feelings. Maybe there's anger. Maybe there's bitterness. Perhaps your giant is simply a lack of trust. Or maybe you felt betrayed in the past and you think, I'm not going to let anyone in anymore. I'm not going to trust man anymore. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I can guarantee you that as this feast has started to wind down in the last few days, that many of us here have started to think and maybe worry about a giant or two waiting for you when you get back home. I have. Other things that are giants sometimes because we are fearful of them. You know, maybe there are things that this simply cause us to be afraid, whether it's logical or not. I remember the first time a minister approached me and said, you know, we should give an opening or closing prayer. Well, it didn't happen for a few years. I avoided him every time I saw him. That was one of my giants at the time. But you see, we know from past history, because we're here, that giants can be slain. You know, think about guys the first time you were ever asked to give a sermonette or a split sermon. That might have been a giant for you. What's keeping us, brethren, at times from overcoming these giants or growing spiritually? Maybe it's just perhaps our fear of meeting new people or extending hospitality to others. What are some other fears you might have? What other giants? Maybe you're afraid to fail. That was part of my issue, is I didn't want to get up in front of people and say something silly and have my pride hurt. Are you afraid you'll be embarrassed? Maybe you're afraid you'll be rejected by someone. You see, things like this can be just as huge a giants before us because we're too afraid to face them, to defeat them, to go head to head with them, to pray for God to give us strength and courage, and to trust God that He will help us out. Brethren, we've heard unbelievable messages this week and today. The sermon this morning was truly a blessing for us to hear. Every single one of you, brethren, as I look out, are on your way to God's kingdom. And we know that there's still going to be a certain amount of obstacles, or I should stay with consistent, certain giants for us to overcome on our journey. But I tell you, brethren, we can't be afraid of what lies before us. We can't shrink back from our responsibilities that God's given us. What are those things that you're afraid of? Brethren, I ask myself this at times over the years. Do I lack the faith? Ask yourself this. Do I lack the faith to obey God no matter what? Because you remember at baptism, we were explained and told to count the cost. That there was no turning back. I know you all believe that. I know you all were taught that. Do we ever lack the faith to obey God no matter what? Are we afraid of coming to the feast and losing our job so we stay home? Or maybe we're afraid to lose our job so we think, well, I'm going to work on the Sabbath. I remember doing that early on in my calling. Are we afraid to send our tithes in because we just think we just can't afford it? I remember being in that position early on, and I remember a very good friend at the time asking me, and he was said it very lovingly, so I took it well. He said, "Joe, where is your faith?" And I ask you that, brethren. If we're afraid of any of these things, where is our faith? That placard I read to you as we started this, I believe that with my whole heart. Brethren, do we ever forget our commitment to God no matter what? Is there anything in our life more important than Him? Maybe we phrase it this way. Is our very life more important to us than our obedience to God? Turn, if you would, to Psalm chapter 23, verse 4. A very familiar scripture. And we'll kind of jump in here. The thought, we won't read the whole scripture, which we usually hear, or the whole section written together. But just here in Psalm 23, verse 4, we need to have courage, brethren. We need to put our faith in God. It says here in Psalms 23, verse 4, David wrote, he says, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil." Why? He says, "For you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me." What is this saying, brethren? Let's read it again. Read it like you mean it. "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of the death, I will fear no evil." You know why, God? Because you're with me, and I know that your rod and your staff, they will comfort me. Do you believe that? Revelation 2, chapter, verse 10. We'll read over here this message to the Smyrna, was to the Smyrna church originally, but it certainly applies to us today. Revelation 2 and verse 10. Revelation 2, verse 10 says, "Do not fear any of these things which you are about to suffer. Indeed, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation 10 days. But it says, be faithful unto death." Or as I was saying earlier, be faithful no matter what. "And when you are," it says, "be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life." It's a promise. If we don't succumb, if we don't give in, if we don't throw in the towel, this is what we have to look forward to. Let's look at just a few more scriptures. Let's turn back to Joshua, if you would, please. Joshua chapter 1. So we talk about this, these giants that we face. Here's another example in Joshua 1. We can see what God said to Joshua as he was facing his giant. Right? We know that he had to lead the Israelites into the promised land, replacing Moses. And talking about some pretty big shoes to fill, Joshua 1, let's read verses 5 through 9. Joshua 1, verse 5, it says, "No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so will I be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you." Verse 6, his admonition for him. He says, "Be strong and of good courage," to Joshua. He says, "For to this people you shall divide as an inheritance of the land which I swore to their fathers to give them." Verse 7, "Only be strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may prosper wherever you go." Verse 8, "The book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate in it day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success." And then he says, just for good measure, in verse 9, "Have I not commanded you, be strong and of good courage? Don't be afraid," he says. "Do not be afraid nor be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go." Brethren, do you think that maybe these men that we discussed, these men of David, knew about this, what this says here? Had they learned of Joshua from King David? Do you suppose that these mighty men that we've discussed knew what David had done to Goliath through the power of God? I believe that they did. And I believe that they had faith that God would deliver them too. Brethren, it seems that there aren't many people who remember right offhand these men that we discussed this morning, or this afternoon, who did the same thing as David. These names of these giant killers aren't commonly known. But they faced what should have been certain death, and they found the courage to trust in God and slay their giants. And obviously they had a great example to follow in their king and in their leader in battle, King David. And as I think about this story more, I wonder and think that perhaps their courage came from believing that God would surely help their noble cause too, and that he would be with them, just as he was with their leader, King David. You see, they knew, I believe, in their hearts that he would. Brethren, where is your courage going to come from? Where is your courage going to come from? Have we considered the example that we've been given so far today? And obviously the best example we could consider is Jesus Christ. When I think about courage, turn over to Psalm chapter 91. When I think about courage, or the courage that we all must have when facing our giants, I think about Psalm 91 and verse 4. I find this very comforting. When things get tough, when we're facing our giants, when it all seems to be lost and we just don't think that we have the strength to defeat him. Psalm 91 says this. It says that he shall cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you shall take refuge. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. Verse 5 says, "You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by day, nor of the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor of the destruction that lays waste at noonday." Brethren, do you have the courage to believe what it says there? Do you have confidence and faith in statements like that? Or are you really fearful of the things that are coming? Our commitment to God, brethren, must be complete and total. And we have been taught this from day one, but we have to remind ourselves that we can't hold back anything. Again, remember when we were baptized, we totally surrendered to him. Remember we said, "It's not my life anymore, it's yours." And on that day, brethren, we pledged to do whatever he asked us to do in service to him. Right? It's nothing new. We know, we're told we are slaves to God, slaves to righteousness. And God expects us to face the future head on as men of mighty valor. Men and women, I should say, of mighty valor. I think there's a certain amount of honor and integrity in those words. I want to take you through just a couple scriptures that I use and look at when I'm facing a giant in my life. First one, we'll turn over to a couple of these. Philippians 4, verses 6 and 7. When that giant comes back, starts peeking over my shoulder, and I start to worry about it and thinking, how am I going to deal with this time? I look at a few of these. Philippians 4, verses 6 and 7. It tells us, be anxious for nothing. Not to be anxious about this and not that, but he says, be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Jesus Christ. I believe that with my whole heart. Do you? You can write down Colossians 3, verse 15. Look at it later. I like this one too. It tells me, and you, it says, let the peace of God rule in your hearts, to which also you were called in one body, and be thankful. And the last one I'll have you write down is John 14, verse 27. It says this, peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. Not as the world gives do I give to you. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid. Brethren, do we remember when things get tough that God is in charge of everything at all times? As we start to wrap up, brethren, I'm going to ask you, can we not learn from the examples of Abishai, Sibbecai, Elhanan, and Jonathan? Can't we learn from them that it's obvious that we just can't give up no matter what? It's an absolute must that we have to keep fighting our giants, even though they or their brothers or their sons, as we saw here, keep coming back, keep attacking us over and over again. And we know, we've been taught, and we believe it, Satan's not going to give up until he's locked away. And we know our battles aren't over, and we know there are some giants outside that door waiting for us when we leave this feast. But let me ask you, brethren, are you going to let yourself get discouraged and give up? Or are you going to be determined to continue fighting no matter what it takes to defeat the enemy? Do you remember what Paul said right before he died? Let's look at one last scripture here. 2 Timothy 4, verse 7. He said simply this. He says, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Brethren, after the news came to David that for the fourth time a Philistine giant from Gath had been slain in a miraculous way by one of his men, David realized how God was continuing to offer his protection and his blessings. And as a result, he composed a song that we sing. And I'll read to you a couple lines. It says, Thee will I love, O Lord, my might, my rock, my help, my saving power. My God, my trust, my shield and fight, my great salvation, my high tower. And I think you know the rest. Brethren, let's trust God to help us deal with any giant that we encounter in our lives. And I want to close today by reading to you once again this placard that sits on my desk. And I'm going to read it to you the way that I read it every morning. I have the powerful awareness that I've made the right decision and am moving in the right direction. I will let nothing and no one detour, distract, depress, or defeat me. I will be faithful. I will be persistent. I will be determined. And I will not quit. Brethren, let's be filled with the courage that we need to go out and overcome. Let's go out and slay some giants. And let's commit right here and now, brethren, to overcome our giants so that we may endure to the end. I hope to see every single one of you back next year at the Feast of Tabernacles. Have a safe trip home.